Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On August 9th, 2014, Michael Brown was shot and killed by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old, was left lying face down for about 4 hours. With blood streaming from his head, shaken up neighbors uploaded photos and videos to social media that would soon go viral. The next day, peaceful protesters were in the streets, shortly followed by heavily armed police officers. Video footage of unrest in the streets, tear gas, arrests, and charges of vandalism and rioting went viral immediately on social media. The hashtag Black Lives Matter that was coined after the death of another unarmed black teenager, Trayvon Martin, in 2012, became the anthem of a growing movement. It's been 1 year since the Black Lives Matter movement gained national attention. Since then, 24 states have adopted measures to reform police practices. Racial justice and police brutality issues are now making it into the platforms of presidential hopefuls. Bernie Sanders just released a major paper on that. So what substantial changes have been made? What else is needed? Where is Black Lives Matter today? What is its goal? Today we are joined by three guests. Ron Davis is the father of Jordan Davis. On November 23, 2012, 17-year-old Jordan Davis was killed by Michael Dunn in Jacksonville, Florida. Michael Dunn pulled in next to Jordan and three of his friends in a gas station parking lot. Michael and Jordan exchanged angry words over the loud music that was playing in the boy's car. Michael Dunn grabbed a gun out of his glove compartment and shot 10 bullets into the car. Jordan Davis was killed. Michael Dunn left the gas station with his girlfriend, went to a hotel, and ordered pizza. He never called the police. Jurors found Michael Dunn guilty of first-degree murder in the second trial, and that story is told in the documentary Three and a Half Minutes, 10 Bullets. And we did a show about this last month, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Ron Davis is president of the Jordan Davis Foundation, where he continues to fight Stand Your Ground laws, and he joins us on the line from Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Ron. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. How are you, Ro? Thank you.
Good. Thank you so much for joining us. We are also joined by Tara Thompson, director with Hands Up United, a grassroots collective with a mission to liberate oppressed black, brown, and poor people through education, art, civil disobedience, and advocacy. Hands Up United formed after the murder of Mike Brown in Ferguson. Hi, Tara. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We are also joined by Sergeant Yolanda Williams. She's with the San Francisco Police Department and president of the group Officers for Justice. And Yolanda joins me in studio. Hi, Yolanda. Thanks for coming back.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. So, Ron, I want to start off with you. I understand that 3 and a Half Minutes, 10 Bullets was recently shown in Ferguson, and you were there interacting with the audience and talking after the film. Just talk about what that experience was like to not only screen the film in Ferguson, but to be there around the year anniversary.
Well, yes, it was. It was tremendous. I really saluted the people in Ferguson for being soldiers, because it takes soldiers to do what they have done over 100 days of marching and protesting. And most people, they don't have that the way to stick to it. And they're showing the whole country that they were not going to go away. Actually, when it happened in Ferguson in August, I was on my way to the United Nations conference, and they asked me to speak at the United Nations conference in Geneva, Switzerland. And I was the first one to speak about Ferguson and about the racial discrimination that was plaguing our country. And these people, all over the world, they started looking into the stories of racial discrimination in America, because we're supposed to tell all the other countries about humanitarian issues, and here we are. We can't get past discrimination in our country. So Ferguson was great. The response was great. We had about 300 people in Washington University, and I just thought it was a tremendous outpouring of affection for the film and for us as a family.
Ron, when you were on the show a month ago, we were just talking about what a journey this has been for you and Jordan's mom. I mean, not only did you share your personal story in the film, because, again, in 3 and a Half Minutes, 10 Bullets, we almost feel like we're in the courtroom with you yeah. and Jordan's mom. And it's so raw and just really emotional. But you've also just dedicated your life now to raising awareness about these issues and fighting the Stand Your Ground laws. So how are you reflecting at a time when, you know, we're all looking back at what has happened over the last year?
Well, when you look at it, the gun manufacturers, what they've done is they've sent out the NRA, given them money to make sure that these laws protect the gun owners. And so therefore, you have guns flying off the shelves in places like Walmart and Kmart and all these places that should be selling Pampers. Instead, they're selling guns. And then you see all these shootings. These shootings are of unarmed people. I want you to look at that and understand that most of the shootings that you've seen over the last 2 years, the victims are always unarmed, you know, and that's incredible that there's no other way for law enforcement or any citizen to subdue anyone other than to take their lives. And I know they had it in Texas very recently where they fired and killed a kid in Texas, you know, and it continues to happen all across this country. And so what I say is not only do the laws have to change, if Stand Your Ground is embedded in the self-defense law, if you look at your state like California, they don't have a Stand Your Ground law, but if you look at their self-defense law, there's a Stand Your Ground wording in the self-defense law. So basically most states do have it. And what we need to do, not only change the law, we need to amend Stand Your Ground. Number one, duty to retreat. We all should have a duty to retreat if we can retreat safely. Number two, there should be a judge and a jury to determine whether Stand Your Ground exists, not just one judge as it is right now. And thirdly, we want to make sure that your family and my family is not considered collateral damage, because if you're coming out of a movie theater right now and two people are standing their ground, they shoot at each other and miss, do you realize that when your children or you get hit and killed, that under Stand Your Ground, you're considered collateral damage, that they can't prosecute you in a criminal trial, nor can they prosecute you in a civil trial? And that's absolutely ridiculous. I think it's a not only a civil rights violation, but it's a human rights violation. And the white supremacy of this country, I keep telling people, it's not just white people in this country. There's a separation between white people and white supremacists. The white supremacists are the KKK affiliates. They want to take this country back to where it was in the 40s and the 50s. And you see it all over the state of Texas. Right now, they have a lot of law enforcement that they found that were actually part of the KKK. In Florida, they found the same thing. They fired two officers in Orlando, Sanford area for being members, active members of the KKK, wearing a badge and wearing their guns. And that's what we have all across this country.
That is Ron Davis. He's the father of Jordan Davis. Jordan was killed on November 23rd, 2012. At the time, he was 17. It happened in a gas station parking lot in Jacksonville, Florida. And I hope you can see the amazing documentary about Jordan's life and his parents' fight for justice. In the documentary, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets. We're also joined by Tara Thompson. She's director with Hands Up United. This is a group that formed after the murder of Mike Brown. It's a grassroots collective that works with people on the ground. And Tara, so much media attention for obvious reasons about Ferguson. I was just reading reports that the state of emergency may be lifted after a quiet night in Ferguson. Before we talk about what's currently happening, why don't you go back a year? Because you have often said that after the killing of Michael Brown, people in Ferguson really didn't even have space to grieve because the, you know, the military or the military-like police, huge cars came into town, the Humvees that looked like Humvees, and they were, you know, police were in military garb. So first off, just talk a little bit about what that is like and what that conversation like sounds like a year later.
What it's like to go into your neighborhood and see a force that is supposed to be protecting you there doing the exact opposite with LRADs and MRAVs and grenade launchers, armored vehicles, assault rifles loaded with both live ammunition and rubber bullets. They have dogs. Anyone that knows anything about Black history and the civil rights movement knows that entering a Black neighborhood, a Black space with dogs is an instant trigger for that community. So it looks like terrorism is what it looks like when your neighborhood has been turned into a war zone by the force that is supposed to be protecting you, and they are doing so with what seems like permission from the government and your tax dollars. It looks a lot, it feels a lot like terrorism.
And so you saw this, I mean, this was your reality almost immediately after Michael Brown was killed?
This has been my reality since August 10th of 2014. It started on August 9th. I didn't leave the house on August 9th. I was pretty much paralyzed, just looking at what equates to a modern-day lynching. And as a person that spent time in Canfield as a young adult, and as a black person that grew up in St. Louis, I would venture to say at least 50% of the people in this city have spent time in Canfield. So when I think about what happened with Mike and his murder, I don't have to reach far to think that that could have been me. So this absolutely has been the reality here since August 9th of 2014, and we're talking about flashbang grenades and people being tear gassed, and you can't contain tear gas. So I've had conversations with little girls that live in Canfield and live close to where the gas is dispensed, that every day at a certain time would begin to wet towels to cover the cracks in the windows and the doors so that they could breathe on the inside of their home.
So, you know, in addition to thinking about issues about police and brutality and race and justice and laws and all of these other issues, I mean, you're all having to deal with the realities of potentially being tear gassed on a regular basis.
Yep, on a regular basis, being tear gassed. Some of the canisters that were used last year are the same canisters that are being used in Gaza. I mean, as we all know, tear gas has been made illegal by the United Nations. We traveled to Geneva in November to testify for the Torture Council on the human rights violations that were occurring here. And where do you go when you have gone to the federal government and you have gone to the United Nations and there is still no changes being made? Where do you go after that?
Tara Thompson is director with Hands Up. This is a grassroots collective that works to liberate oppressed black, brown, and poor people. Now, in addition to dealing with all of this, Tara, I understand that you have all started some amazing programs. Books for Breakfast, you're giving free books that are African-centric. You feed the community with healthy breakfast. You're teaching young people how to code, and they're building websites for small black businesses.
Yep, those are the two programs that we've launched so far, and they've been going for quite some time now. The Books and Breakfast is now in at least 20 cities nationally. As a result of us launching this program, we're in touch with at least 20 cities that are now doing Books and Breakfast or some form of Books and Breakfast in their cities, and that is exactly what it is. It is, we're giving out free books and free breakfast to the community. We have adult books and kids books. Every month, there is a different theme. Last month's theme was hip-hop and lyrics. We taught the history of hip-hop, the components of hip-hop, and how to use hip-hop as a tool of resistance. Some of the other themes that we've had this year have been Michelle Alexander and the New Jim Crow, Patrice Lumumba, which was the first prime minister of the Congo, Ella Baker. And we also have the tech program, which is a six-week program that teaches St. Louis area residents between the ages of 16 and 30 HTML, JavaScript, CSS, how to build websites. They are all assigned to a small business here, a small minority-owned business. And at the end of the 6 weeks, they deliver this business a website. And we're now in our second cohort of the tech program, and we are looking to launch three within the next month. The class that's going now, they actually graduate on Sunday. So in the midst of the war zone, I have to make sure that these kids graduate. So I was treading very lightly all weekend and this week trying not to get arrested because we only have 3 more classes for graduation.
Wow. Tara Thompson is in Ferguson. She's director with Hands Up United, a grassroots collective that is doing so many amazing things on the ground there. At the same time, while feeling like living in a war zone, Yolanda Williams is with the San Francisco Police Department and president of Officers for Justice. You've been feverishly taking notes over here, Yolanda. What goes through your mind when you hear a young woman like Tara talk about what she's dealing with today in Ferguson?
I can only express my deep concern, and I want to apologize for what you and other citizens in Ferguson are experiencing at this time. It is truly unfortunate that Ferguson is not alone, because other cities across the nation are experiencing, maybe not at the same depth as Ferguson, but the same examples of racism. And it's unfortunate to find that based upon the number of experiences that black and brown people are having with law enforcement, that's resulting in the death of many of our young people, there is now major distrust. And currently, a large number of citizens that I communicate with as the president of the Officers for Justice also indicate that there is a lack of trust for the police officers, those who are sworn to protect and serve others. And my heart goes out to you. My heart goes out to Mr. Davis and many other parents who have lost someone that is true, near and dear to them. The only thing that I can say is that it is time for reform, and it is time for us to, as citizens of this country, to be able to determine what type of policing we want delivered in the various communities.
Tara, have you had many conversations or any conversations with police officers in Ferguson?
I've had so many conversations with police in Ferguson, with our St. Louis County Police, with our St. Louis City Police. I've had conversations with the Department of Justice. I've sat in meetings with the Department of Justice last August, left the meeting, went around the corner 5 minutes, and was promptly tear gassed. I've sat in meetings, and if meetings were going to be the way to resolve it, we would be done. Mm.
What are your thoughts, Yolanda, about the conversations that are having and that are taking place? What would you say to Tara? I mean, what do you think citizens can do about this?
I think that we need to use our frustration to generate synergy. And when I say synergy, I'm really personally tired of talking. I want action. And I think that at this point in time, there are enough citizens across the nation for us to actually have a day that we just declare is the day that we are going to seek and get the justice that we so deserve. I mean, I've listened to the fact that we have these grand jury panels, and yet we're not entitled to read the transcripts or find out the results of what has happened, how they came to some conclusions and some decisions. That is absolutely ridiculous. It's almost like, even though I'm living in the United States, it almost feels like it's almost like an apartheid, what we've been talking about and what we hear other countries experiencing. It's going on right here in the United States, and we still have politicians that unfortunately refuse to act upon the concerns that we have. And I want to share with you, Tara, that you're not alone in your frustrations, because here in San Francisco, we are experiencing the same thing. We have a mayor that refuses to meet with the black communities. We have a mayor that refuses to meet with the Officers for Justice. And had it not been for the Officers for Justice, there would not be black officers, Asian officers, all other diverse officers, and men, women, and LGBT the departments across the nation would not look as diverse had it not been for organizations like the Officers for Justice. And I want to tell you, if there's anything we can do to help you, we are here and we are willing to step up to the plate and take action with you.
Tara?
I'm here.
Would you like to respond?
I would be interested in having a further conversation offline about what we can do. My goal, quite honestly, is to build community so that we don't even call the police. I at this point, I am feeling not very hopeful about reforming the system that is actually operating the way that it was designed to operate. And quite frankly, until it becomes expensive, both in embarrassment with the United States around the world, which is starting to happen, and economically, for black bodies to be brutalized and dropped by police and law enforcement, until that becomes expensive, it's not going to change. So I want to start thinking about ways that we can make this expensive.
I hear what you're saying, and it's very interesting, because what you are speaking about is what I have spoken about to some of the communities here in San Francisco, is that if we were enabled to, and if we accepted the responsibility to police ourselves, we could do far greater service to our communities. Because we know what's going on. And, you know, this takes us back to the way it was in the 50s and the 60s, when just because you were someone else's child, as an adult, I had a responsibility to tell you right from wrong. And if your parents weren't home to discipline you, I also had that right to do that, because I was looking out for your best interest and your protection. And I'd rather see a parent exercise and implement the discipline on their child than for me to have to do it under the auspices of being a police officer, or under the auspices of the criminal justice system taking care of what we should be taking care of. So I embrace and applaud you, Tara, for your commitment, your actions, and the fact that you are standing up as a courageous black woman. It's remarkable.
Thank you.
Yolanda Williams is with the San... Oh, Ron, go ahead. Jump in there.
Yeah. What I want to say is this, because I know what Tara's going through. We probably bump into each other on several occasions, that one of the things that you have to do in this policing of America is this. The Southern Poverty Law Group have already identified certain pockets across the nation of white supremacist KKK affiliates. We as a nation, we don't take action on this. Now, we say, well, these people are Americans, and until they kill or hurt somebody, we're not going to step in. But, you know, when these kids want to go and join ISIS, they catch them before they leave the United States, before they get a chance to do anything, and they arrest them, and they take away their rights as an American, and they lock them up. And they just did so yesterday, I believe. They caught somebody else trying to join ISIS. So don't tell me that you can't do that to these people, because they are domestic terrorists. The people of color and to Jewish people, the KKK and its affiliates are domestic terrorists. They've been terrorizing us for decades. So why can't you step in, look at their computers, and see that they're hate mongers and that they threaten the mere fabric of being in black America, and arrest them for something they do before they do it? Why do you have to wait till nine people are slaughtered in Charleston, South Carolina, before you arrest one of them?
And Ron,
you can arrest them now.
Ron, hold that thought. Today on Your Call, we are talking about Black Lives Matter, a year after the movement really began and really, really grew after the killing of Michael Brown on August 9th, 2014. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation on Your Call on the phone or by sending an email. The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. The toll-free number is 866 798 talk, 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, World Have Your Say, and following that at noon, it's This American Life.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how communities are regaining control over their energy from big utilities. Right now, there are two community choice aggregation organizations in the state, Marin Clean Energy and Sonoma Clean Power Authority. So what will it take for more communities to gain control of their energy choices? That's tomorrow. Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about Black Lives Matter a year after Michael Brown was shot and killed by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. Brown was an unarmed 18-year-old. He was left lying face down for about 4 hours. And we have had such a conversation in this country about race, about police. So many people are talking about these issues. What has really changed? What are your thoughts on the conversations that you are hearing about and seeing in the media? Are minds changing? What about policies? We'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts a year later? 866-798-8255. How have your views changed? How have you been affected by this movement? 866-798-8255. If you have questions for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Ron Davis. He's the father of Jordan Davis. On November 23rd, 2012, 17-year-old Jordan Davis was killed by Michael Dunn in Jacksonville, Florida. They were both parked in separate cars in a gas station parking lot. Michael and Jordan exchanged angry words over loud music. It was playing in Jordan's car with his three friends. Michael Dunn grabbed a gun out of his glove compartment, shot 10 bullets into the car, and killed Jordan Davis. Michael Dunn was found guilty of first-degree murder in the second trial. The story is told in the documentary 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. Ron Davis is in the movie. You feel like you're in the courtroom with him and Jordan's mom. Ron is president of the Jordan Davis Foundation, where he continues to fight Stand Your Ground laws. We're also joined by Tara Thompson, director with Hands Up United, a grassroots collective that works on the ground in Ferguson. Sergeant Yolanda Williams is with the San Francisco Police Department, president of Officers for Justice, and Officers for Justice advocates for the civil rights of people of color, women, and LGBT people. In March, the SFPD came under fire for racist text messages, and Yolanda was in one of those text messages. Again, you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Yolanda, Ron was bringing up members of the KKK who are in police departments across the country, and you wanted to elaborate on that.
Yes, Ron. It's interesting that you bring up a point which I actually hit on when we found out about this TexGate scandal. And unfortunately, here in San Francisco, there is now the possibility that in a case that is going to determine when the administration, i.e. the chief and his command staff, were notified about this incident, because that is going to determine whether or not the city will be able to terminate the employment of these folks who were involved in some very hate-filled conversations, text conversations. And to me, I find that the most appalling thing of all. And I agree with you. When an officer, whether on duty or off duty, acts or has conversations or involves themselves in anything that would provoke hatred to the extent of the KKK, ISIS, or anything else, they should immediately be terminated without any second thought.
And Michael Robinson, who served as an SFPD officer for 23 years, resigned over those texts. What else has happened since then?
Well, also we have the originator of the text conversations, Ian, who is now serving time, federal time, for some other issues, but he was one of the initiators of this. But then we have still the other eight that are apparently still on administrative leave. However, they're getting paid the entire time. And what's most insulting is the fact that they may come back to work and we're supposed to be expected to work side by side with them. Mm-hmm. And one of these folks at the rank of a captain. So, Ron, I agree with you 110%.
Well, Yolanda, just like I'm also on the planning committee of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and we have a biannual convention in December 13th, and it's going to be in Austin, Texas. And now in Austin, Texas, just past June, they found that two officers were active members of the KKK, and they fired these two officers. And we're talking about just June 20th of this year, you know, and in Florida, December 2014, they found that one chief deputy and another lieutenant in the Sanford, Orlando, Central Florida area, they were active members of the KKK. So they're all around the country. And you can't start good policing until you eradicate the KKK members and their affiliates like the White Knights, you know, from being law officers. You know, when you look at somebody's arrest record, and 95 and 98% of the people they arrest or kill are people of color, don't that ring a bell? Mm-hmm. And it does ring a bell, you know? And so these are the things. The Sanford, Florida may be 2% African-American, but all of a sudden 98% of the people you arrest are African-American. And they know this. The Southern Law Poverty Group, that you know this, but you won't act on it. That's what I agree with Tara, because, you know, you don't have any type of thought that there's good policing, you know, and that's why she says, yeah, well, maybe our neighborhood should start taking that back from the police, because the police, you know, they're KKK members or affiliates, and they're wearing badges and uniforms. You think they're going to obey the law? No. They're going to say those five words that they've been taught to say whenever they shoot somebody: I fear for my life. That's what they all say.
Exactly. And their fear is what is promoting violence that's resulting in death. And I agree with you 100%. The other thing I want to say to both Tara and Ron is please make sure that you get our contact numbers here in San Francisco for the Officers for Justice, because if that conference is open in December, Ron, I would like to see if I can get out there to Texas to meet with you and some of the other folks who are experiencing the same things that we're experiencing here in California, because we're not exempt from anything, and no longer can we boast about the fact that we're setting the example for other law enforcement agencies across the nation, because we're no better than anyone else. We all have the same problems that we must deal with.
And I hope the state can send each one of us our information, your cell phone numbers, to each one of our participants here today, because we need to contact each other.
We will definitely send that out after the show. And Tara, you want to jump in?
Yeah, to further, you know, the point that Mr. Davis is making, and I have on my Walk with Jordan bracelet right now as we're but to further his point, okay, so you have a situation where the Department of Justice came into Ferguson and, you know, wrote these angry reports, these scathing reports, condemning the entire Department of Ferguson, right? You have these racist emails and these texts. And it's blatantly obvious based on the numbers that they're extorting black people in this community for profit. It's blatantly obvious that the numbers of black people that are arrested are vastly disproportionate to the numbers of white people. If you travel to Ferguson, you can absolutely tell the difference in the housing on the white side of Ferguson versus the housing and the resources on the black side of Ferguson. So you want me to trust people that have written a scathing report condemning the entire department and at the same time write a report that says Darren Wilson was not racially motivated when he murdered Mike Brown. So you want me to believe that Darren Wilson was the only good apple in the Ferguson Police Department? These are the people that you want me to trust. So when I am stepping out of my car or being pulled over for a traffic violation, I don't have any time at that point to discern a good cop from a bad cop. Hmm. There's no time for that. Because they don't have different colored shirts on. There's no sign that says, I am a good one. And there is nothing. I spoke with an FBI agent about a memo that the FBI released saying, hey, heads up, we think that we have KKK and white supremacists infiltrating police departments. I asked this FBI person about this, and he basically said the same thing to me that Mr. Davis is saying, in that you cannot arrest someone for a crime before the crime is committed. So again, why do we have so many police if you can't prevent crime? What are you doing? You can't prevent crime based on the fact that St. Louis is the most dangerous city in the world, not the country, the world. It doesn't seem that our police are solving any crimes either. So I'm very, very wary about being able to trust any of this when you being the proverbial you, have not even recognized the problem enough to get these officers that we know are a problem off the force.
And what the FBI said to her is a lie, because just the other day they arrested two people that were getting on a plane to go and join ISIS. Well, they arrested them before they did anything.
Exactly.
So don't tell me you can't arrest people before they do something.
And Tara, I agree that the
officer that killed Christian Taylor in Texas is a 49-year-old white man that just left the academy. Can someone tell me what 49-year-old white man decides at 49 that he wants to be a police officer? He leaves the academy, four shots, Christian Taylor is dead. The training officer that was with him pulled his taser. Help me understand that.
And for people who don't know, I was just reading about Christian last night. I'm just reading an AP lead here. A police officer in suburban Dallas shot and killed a college football player during a struggle after the unarmed 19-year-old crashed a car through the front window of a car dealership. Christian Taylor was a sophomore at Angelo State University in San Angelo, and officers responded to a burglary call at 1 o'clock. And Brad Miller, the 49-year-old, who was with the department since last September and working under the supervisor of a training officer, shot and killed this young man, this 19-year-old.
Well, you know,
Christian
Tara,
Taylor.
The one thing that I'm concerned about, too, is that you put officers out there on the streets for 20, 30 years. They've only been psychologically evaluated when they first come in the department.
Yep.
That is atrocious. An officer should be reevaluated by a psychologist every 5 years. My God, they're carrying guns. I need to be psychologically evaluated, quite frankly. I've been in the department 26 years. I haven't killed anyone. I haven't beat up anyone. But guess what? I don't mind. I have nothing to hide. I want transparency. And this is what, folks, we've got to demand. We've got to demand transparency and accountability. Your tax dollars are paying for these officers to police you in a way that is discriminatory. They're being abusive. And we cannot allow this to consistently happen and turn a blind eye.
And they've already fired him. They knew he wasn't, you know, the kind of police that he should have been. They've already fired him on that. But, you know, and looking at San Francisco where you are, you know, I've done a lot of things with Oscar Grant's family out there with
yes.
Uncle Bobby and Wanda. Mm-hmm. And I've been out there, and I know what happened in their case. You know, the guy that killed Oscar Grant, he only spends 11 months in prison, and he fired a weapon in the commission of a crime. What happened to the mandatory 10 years
yeah.
that he
exactly.
got off with?
Exactly.
And then he goes down to Los Angeles and gets a job as a police department in Los Angeles.
Thank you. And then look at Darden, the black officer that they abused, LAPD abused him. But then all of a sudden, every possible officer, it was a major manhunt for Darden. But no one took care of that black officer when he first had the problems with members of the police department, when he first experienced racism. And I'm telling you, that's the same thing that's happened with me and two other officers that we know were named in the Texgate scandal. Not once has the investigative unit within the police department given me an update as to what's going on. Never once did they ask me, do you feel safe or are you concerned because these people have indicated things that they want to do to people of color. To me, that's the atrocity. I wear a blue uniform, but I'm still black. I'm never going to be blue enough to be accepted like every other member of the police department. And that's sad.
Yolanda, are you working side by side with the people who sent the texts about you?
Not right now, but after September 3rd, I could be working alongside them. And also, besides me being concerned about them, the potential is that's where there's two or three, there's more. Mm. So my concern is it's time for psychological testing on everyone. It's time to really start dealing with this racism and not just saying, oh, you just had 2 hours training. You're all cured of your racism now.
Yolanda Williams is with the San Francisco Police Department. She's been there for 26 years. She's the president of Officers for Justice. This association was formed in 1968 to advocate for the civil rights of people of color, women, and LGBT people. We were talking about the text scandal, and Yolanda was the subject of some of these texts that were offensive to people of color and women specifically. We're also joined by Tara Thompson, director with Hands Up United. This is a grassroots collective with a mission to liberate oppressed black, brown, and poor people through advocacy, civil disobedience, education. They've been doing some amazing work on the ground. There's a Books with Breakfast program. They're teaching young people how to code, and they're making websites for small black-owned businesses. And we're joined by Ron Davis, the father of Jordan Davis, who was killed November 23rd. He was 17, killed by Michael Dunn in a gas station parking lot in Jacksonville, Florida. Again, I hope you can see this documentary, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets, which tells this story. Michael Dunn was found guilty of first-degree murder in the second trial. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're talking about Black Lives Matter a year after the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson. Let's go to Amim in Berkeley. Hi, Amim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you for having me. So I just wanted to kind of speak to the question you presented earlier, just how, you know, all these events have sort of affected my personal life. I think it definitely has created this hyper sense of awareness in my identity. Driving while black, walking while black, I'm definitely more aware of that and have to be a lot more careful in my daily routines as opposed to, you know, a couple of years back, I probably wouldn't have thought of it as much. So when I'm driving now and I see a police officer, I get super anxious, honestly, and, you know, thinking, did I do something wrong? You know, did I flick my signal like Sandra Bland allegedly forgot to do when she was turning over in a lane? Mm. And things like that, you know, I'm definitely way more concerned. I'm not even worried about, you know, walking into the roughest neighborhoods in, you know, the East Bay. I'm more worried about the cops because, you know, as they're supposed to be people who are supposed to be protecting us, they're also causing much more harm and damage in our community as well. So it's definitely really hard, and it, you know, it's an extra burden, an extra layer that I have to carry around as a, you know, black woman.
Wow, thank you for sharing that experience. Yolanda, what would you say to Amim?
Amim, I concur and I understand your concerns because even though I'm a police officer, believe it or not, when I'm off duty and I'm driving around, as soon as I see some red lights or I see the police, I start to panic. Mm. And I seriously panic to the point where if I'm stopped, I'm immediately saying, I have a weapon in the car. Please don't do anything. I'm not going to make any movements. Let me just show you my hands. I mean, I understand because everyone wants to feel like you're safe. So in order for us to be safe, we have to take as many precautions as possible. It's not fair that we have to exist or coexist in a society in this manner. But I understand, my sister, where you're coming from, and my heart goes out to you as well.
Thank you for calling, Amim. Because we spent a lot of time talking about police and what we're referring to as reform today, there's so much talk about training, about unconscious bias. We've done so many shows about this. You were talking about, you know, the racism inside the force among police officers. And then I was just reading about how the Columbia Police Officers Association declared August 9th as Darren Wilson Day. And they put a post up on their Facebook page, but because there was so much backlash, they took it down. So what are your thoughts on this, Yolanda? I mean, beyond the training and all of these conversations about unconscious bias, and I mean, what else do you want to see to make real change here?
Well, first of all, I want to see the police departments actually be able to sit down with their rank and file members and talk about race relations in a environment where everyone is on equal playing field. And I'd like to see community members involved in it, and that we have some mental health professionals there so that we can really have those heartfelt conversations. There's a group called Moving Beyond Tolerance, which is a local group here in San Francisco. And they provide some diversity training and give you applicable methods of trying to tone down some of your racial biases that you may have. But by far and large, we have to first come to terms and to an agreement that we're going to agree that racism exists. When I look at a letter dated June 24th by the police association that represents San Francisco officers that says our police department is not corrupt, not racially biased, and not mistrusted by the public, it is also not without problems. But see, again, that's a watered down version of saying that racism is systemic in law enforcement agencies. No one is exempt. Racism is in existence in the private sector. So what makes you think that it's not going to be in existence in a police culture?
Well, and again, look how it's affecting someone like Amim, and I'm sure so many
exactly.
others like her. Well, thank you for sharing that story. We have time for maybe two more calls. Let's hear from Erica in San Francisco. Hi, Erica. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for this episode. Firstly, I just want to say I'm sitting in the car with my baby who's napping, and Mr. Davis, I'm so sorry for your loss as a parent. And I wanted to ask you guys, I don't mean to take the conversation too off topic, but Black Lives Matter has done an amazing job of raising awareness and holding people accountable. And I'm wondering if there's any plans for kind of, you had mentioned NRA, and I was wondering if there's any talk or planning on how to raise awareness about their contribution to racism, to political maneuvering, if you guys have any thoughts on that.
Thank you. Ron, do you want to take that one?
Yes, I do talk about that. I will be in Dallas, actually, Texas, in 2 weeks at the T.D. Jakes Mega Fest. And so please come on down. But anyway, we're going to talk about that, is because that is what the problem is. The NRA has 43 million members, okay? And what they do is they use an organization called ALEC, A-L-E-C. And that executive council, they spread whatever the gospel is according to the NRA. And that's how Stand Your Ground started in 2005 when Jeb Bush decided to sign that into state law. And then all of a sudden we have over 20 states now because ALEC spread it around. They take these guys on these little trips to the Caribbean and all these places, and all these lawmakers, they get to go on these little trips. They have campaign contributions that are even above what the maximum is, because they create other groups like the Sporting Life Group and, you know, other groups where they can put more than $120,000 into the campaign of all these lawmakers. So the lawmakers, they are not going to get off the dime to change the laws. But what we need to change is this. We need to make sure, first and foremost, is to make sure that there's a federal mandate to all the states to get rid of these people that are white supremacists that are wearing badges. You know, when you look at these kids with their hands on the wheel and then they being, you know, like Sandra Bland, been taken out of their car, slammed on the ground, you know, these are white supremacists that can't wait to do harm to you. It has nothing to do with the laws. Nothing at all to do with the laws. So what you have to look at is you have to find a way to make sure that every one of these people that are affiliates of these organizations, you have to take their badges off. You have to take the guns out of their hands, because otherwise we're going to keep getting killed. We're going to keep marching till our feet hurt. We're going to keep shouting until we have sore throats, but nothing's going to change until you get the badges and the guns off the white supremacists. And that's what my policy is to do that. I'm using the Human Rights Network to do that, and I hope everybody joins me into making sure that the white supremacists are getting terminated from these positions.
And Ron, to that point, George in San Francisco, sorry, George, we don't have time to take your call, but he wanted to ask, what can people do to raise awareness about this and purge these officers who are affiliated with the KKK?
They can go to Southern Poverty Law, and like in Florida, you have 58 pockets of people that are KKK members. There are people that have like the Tampa Bay Times here in Florida. So every state, they have a way to track. You know, they can track how many seeds are in an orange, but they can't track how many policemen across the country kill unarmed people of color. They said there's no statistics on that. So we have to start making sure that there are statistics on that, because shocking the nation is the only way you're going to change that.
Mm. Well, thank you for that question, George. We have an email from Lisa who says, the NAACP has a journey for justice from Selma to Washington, August 1st to September, excuse me, 16th. I also have been reading about another massive event on November 29th. There's going to be an NAACP journey for justice, Ferguson to Jefferson City. We've got about a minute left, Tara. Final thoughts from you. Where is Hands Up going next? What are your plans?
Hands Up, we are going to continue to develop more programs. We are going to continue to work hard to try to build more community and keep our community safe without calling the police. We are going to try to find resources to attack the genocide that is occurring, because these brutality situations are what they are. These are murders, but this is all... That's one prong of the genocide that is occurring for Black, Brown, and Indigenous people in this country. We are being attacked with the food that is offered in our neighborhoods, the lack of access to health care, the lack of access to good education, and the brutality is yet another prong of this genocide. So Hands Up is going to continue to work to combat the genocide, the attack that is on Black people in this country.
Tara Thompson is director with Hands Up United. Sergeant Yolanda Williams is with the SFPD. She's been there 26 years, and she's president of Officers for Justice. Ron Davis is the father of Jordan Davis. He was killed November 23, 2012, in a gas station parking lot, Jacksonville, Florida, by Michael Dunn, who was found guilty of first-degree murder. Find their story in the documentary 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. Ron, Tara, and Yolanda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to say that you can find it on HBO the 23rd of November, 3.5
Great.
Minutes, 10 Bullets.
Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How are communities regaining control over their energy from big utilities? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about community power. In Northern California, most of us get our energy from PG&E. In 2000, California passed the Community Choice Aggregation Bill, which gives cities and counties more energy options. But today, there are only two CCAs in the state, Marin Clean Energy and Sonoma Clean Power Authority. So what will it take for communities to gain control of their energy choices? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. We'll be right back.